The assignment for next time will be posted on the board. Those of you who do not come back to the building again until next Monday, come and see me at the end of class, and I'll have copies for you then. We have been having assignments lately in events in Zedekiah, in Jeremiah's life in the time of Zedekiah. And we have seen a little of what he had to go through at that time as he stood for God in a nation which had had a tremendous revival under Josiah maybe 20 years before, but had largely lost the results of it and turned away from God, an era which would be much similar to our own time here, which might be called, by carrying the phrase back, a post-Christian era. And so the book of Jeremiah has very great relevance to us today. Now here is a book which is not a commentary on Isaiah, on Jeremiah, and it is not a discussion of the problems we're taking up in this class, but it is an application of them to our present time. It's called Death in the City by Dr. Francis Schaeffer. And right at this point, there are a couple of pages of it that are so appropriate that I would like to read them to you. It's on page 65. He says, "We have already had a glimpse of the personal results to Jeremiah that the preaching of judgment brings. In Anathoth, the people said, 'Keep quiet or we're going to kill you.'" We haven't looked at that particular chapter yet. That was in the early part of his ministry. "The threats to his liberty were not idle, for we read in Jeremiah 20, verse 2, thank you, "Then Pashur smote Jeremiah the prophet and put him in the stocks that were in the high gate of Benjamin, which was by the house of the Lord. The first thing they did was to fasten him in the stocks. Poor Jeremiah, who had been preaching faithfully in the midst of this post-Christian culture, finds himself in the stocks. But his punishment didn't end there. The stocks were not enough for him, so they put him in prison. For then the king of Babylon's army besieged Jerusalem, and Jeremiah the prophet was shut up in the court of the prison, which was in the king of Judah's house. Just as his prophecy is coming true, just as the king of Babylon is at the doors, just as the false prophets are being proven wrong, Jeremiah is put into prison, the prison that's in the king's house. Those who know the Doge's palace in Venice can picture this, because that palace contained the most important prison. Apparently, it was the same here. Later on in 33:1, Jeremiah is still in prison. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto Jeremiah the second time while he was yet shut up in the court of the prison. But even that was not the end. In Jeremiah 37:15-16, we read, "Wherefore the princes were wroth with Jeremiah and smote him, and put him in prison in the house of Jonathan the scribe, for they had made that the prison. When Jeremiah was entered into the dungeon and into the cells, and Jeremiah had remained there many days," end of quote. So they gradually increased the punishment from the stocks to a prison to a dungeon. Finally, as we read in Jeremiah 38:4-6, "Every one of us must be moved. For here is a man of flesh and blood like ourselves, in a historic space-time situation, with his own aspirations, and he's carted off and put into a dungeon. And now his very life is threatened. Therefore the princes said unto the king, 'We beseech thee, let this man be put to death, for thus he weakeneth the hands of the men of war that remain in this city.'" That is, Jeremiah is not giving an optimistic answer. He isn't saying everything's going to turn out well. He isn't saying there's an easy solution. All we need is a little more technical advance to make the grade. He's cutting down their humanistic optimism, saying that they are under the judgment of God and thereby weakening the people, undercutting their morale. They said, "For this man seeketh not the welfare of the people, but the hurt." Of course, it's not true. Jeremiah is wanting their real welfare. He is saying, "You must be healed of the real disease, which is your revolt against God, and not merely of some superficial external wound." But that didn't please the dignitaries. So we read, "Then Zedekiah the king said, 'Behold, he's in your hand, for the king is not he that can do anything against you.' Then took they Jeremiah and cast him into the dungeon that was in the court of the prison, and they let down Jeremiah with cords, And in the dungeon there was no water but mire, so Jeremiah sunk in the mire. The story would make vivid drama, but is not merely a piece of theater. Jeremiah, a man like yourself, was put into the innermost dungeon, where they put a rope around his arms and lowered him down into the mire. As he went down, he must have wondered, what are my feet going to touch? He wasn't going to drown, but there was mud at the bottom, and as they let him down, he sunk, and he sunk, and he sunk, to his knees, to his waist, to his armpits. We do not know, but he was there. There as a result of his faithful preaching of God's judgment to a post-Christian world. It's no small thing to stick with the message. It's easy to opt out. Both hippies and evangelicals easily can opt out into their own little ghetto, saying nice things to themselves and closing their eyes to the real situation that surrounds us. One can opt out in many ways, but if one really preaches the word of God to a post-Christian world, he must understand that he's likely to end up like Jeremiah. We must not think that Jeremiah's trials were merely physical. They were psychological as well. For Jeremiah never saw any change in his own lifetime. He knew that 70 years later the people would return, but he didn't live to see it. Jeremiah, like every man, lived existentially on the knife edge of time, moment by moment. And like all of us, he lived day by day within the confines of his own lifetime. Jeremiah was not just a piece of cardboard. He had a psychological life just as you and I have. How then was he affected? There were times when Jeremiah stood in discouragement, overwhelmed by preaching the message of God faithfully to his culture, and ending up in the stocks, the prison, and the dungeon. You say, how can a man of God be discouraged? Anybody who asks that has never been in the midst of the battle. He understands nothing about a real struggle for God. We're real men. We're this side of the fall. We're not perfect. We have our dreams, our psychological needs, and we want to be fulfilled. There are times of heroism as we stand firm and are faithful in preaching to men who will not listen. But there are also times when we feel overwhelmed. I think there's a very fine treatment in this book by Dr. Schaefer, Death in the City, of the application of much of this material in Jeremiah to our own day. Now, we have been looking at, particularly at the events in the later part of Jeremiah's life. We have much more of autobiography there than we have in the early part, but there's a considerable amount in the early part. And I think we understand the early part much better by having a realization of where it led Jeremiah and what he had to go through before he was finished. And so we have taken this material about gotten a good glimpse of his experiences in the time of Zedekiah at this point. But now I want to go back and start near the beginning of the book. And in general, the rest of the time, we will go through the book. I'm not going to give you a detailed outline of it. It is not an easy book to outline. And you could see easily why this can be. The experiences that he went through, and it was written in the midst of these experiences. Most of it consists of what he actually said in standing before the people. And as you remember, this was written down later as he remembered it, and then the king cut it up, and then he redictated it with other material in between, and then at a later time, certain later events, which seemed to him to fit at certain places, were inserted at those places. So that the book is not strictly chronological, but in general, there is a chronological arrangement to the book. In general, it starts with the beginning of his life, of course, and it goes on in the book to the end of his ministry. Toward the end, there are a few chapters that perhaps don't belong at the very end if you want to be strictly chronological, but which, from a viewpoint of subject matter, are placed at the very end of the book. In fact, those chapters which are placed near the end, the chapters in which he deals with foreign nations and tells of God's, specifically of God's judgment against these nations, that part in the Septuagint is inserted in the middle of chapter 25, Back there where it tells how Jeremiah gave messages of God's punishment to other nations, then the Septuagint has the last few chapters of Jeremiah, except the last chapter, but the ones immediately before it, at that point, and then continues with the rest of it. I don't know whether the translator of the Septuagint was trying to make the whole thing more chronological than it is in inserting it at that point. I think that the arrangement we have in the Hebrew is probably better because the subject matter of those is quite different. And therefore, even though they were given probably long before the end of his ministry, to have them at the end of it. But aside from them, it is in general quite chronological. The events of Jeremiah's life would fall under four heads, as I believe you all know by this time. First would be the events under Josiah. And the early chapters are doubtless material that he gave in the time of Josiah. That would be from the 13th to the 18th year of Josiah. In other words, the first 5 years of Jeremiah's ministry were before the great revival that Josiah conducted. And then from the 18th to the 31st year would be after the great revival. But there's no division in the book of Jeremiah to show us whether particular chapters come before or after that event. But there are the early chapters of the book, perhaps at least a third of the book, consists of what he said during that period, interspersed with occasional complaints by him, an occasional reference to an event, and occasional prayer by him. And so this, since in the Hebrew it just goes right straight along, and so mostly in the King James Version too, we have to supply our own headings and make our own divisions. It makes it in a way more convenient to get at the chapter divisions that were put in by the archbishop in the 13th century. In another way, they're apt to be misleading because quite frequently the archbishop's judgment wasn't very good as to where divisions should be made. But that is the first part of his ministry under Josiah, and at least a third of the book probably came during that time. The second part of it cannot be sharply divided from the first. There are chapters we know belong in the second because it's so stated. But we don't know how much of the first may have been in the second period or may even have been repeated then. The second, of course, would be under Jehoiakim. We don't need to make a special division for the three-month reign of Jehoahaz, who was carried off by Pharaoh into Egypt, because we have no evidence whether any particular part of the book was written during those 3 months or not. So the second is under Jehoiakim, a period in which Jeremiah was protected. There were many leaders among the people who had a strong desire to protect him, and did. We read some time ago, you all read about how the king wanted to kill him, and the leaders prevented him. But the king was able to send clear to Egypt to get another prophet who had given a message very similar to Jeremiah's, and seize him in Egypt and bring him back and kill him. And so we see that the king's hatred was very great, and his power was great, and there must have been, these officials must have had a very great interest in Jeremiah and a very great power in the kingdom, that they were able to protect him during that time. We have a number of chapters which are specifically connected to his relation to Jehoiakim. Some of the first part of the book may have been given at that time or may have been repeated at that time. Of course, where it's not stated, we don't know. Then the third, of course, is under Zedekiah. And this was a time when Jeremiah was greatly honored by some, as you know. You remember how Ebed-Melech was able to preserve his life, even though he was probably not a man with any great influence, but he was placed in a strategic position there where he was able to bring the complaint to the king, and he was able to
under the king's orders to take 30 men and go and rescue Jeremiah out of the dungeon in the deep mire in which he had been. But the leaders of the people at this time seem to have been quite hostile to Jeremiah and wanted to kill him. But the king, though he was a weak king, afraid of the leaders, he was able to protect him during that period. Now there is a fourth period, a brief one, after the fall of Jerusalem. And we have a few rather interesting and important events that took place in Jeremiah's life and prophecies specifically given at that time. We haven't looked at them yet, and we will leave them until we come to them in going through the book. Now, as I said, we cannot divide the book strictly into these four divisions. We cannot do it because it is not arranged strictly chronologically. We cannot be sure in some cases which time a prophecy was given, but in general, it's rather clear. And of course, the last of them after the fall of Jerusalem is made quite definite in the book. He might have repeated some of his earlier messages, but we have no reason to think he gave new messages other than those that are specifically designated as such for that period. Now I want to start going through the book. I think what we've looked at so far gives you a background for it that makes it much easier to understand than if we had simply started at the first without having looked at these later chapters to some extent. Now, I'm not going to divide it into main heads because it is rather difficult to do that, but simply sections. And so the first section would, of course, be the first chapter that we have already looked at. Section one of the book would be chapter one, which is Jeremiah's call. And the statements in that chapter that we looked at about how God was going to bring punishment, you've already seen the fulfillment of them in what we've looked at thus far. And the statement in it, in verse 18, "Today I have made you a fortified city, an iron pillar, and a bronze wall to stand against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, its officials, its priests, and the people of the land. They will fight against you, but will not overcome you, for I am with you and will rescue you, declares the Lord." Jeremiah, I'm sure, in the 13th year of Josiah, had no full realization of just what these verses meant. But certainly as time went on, and he had this tremendous opposition to me, and saw others being killed for doing exactly what he was doing, and saw the tremendous effort, the tremendous opposition and antagonism and denial of God in the land, he must have realized how wonderful it was that God had given him this promise. And so we do have occasionally, he gives way to great complaints. We have expression of his terrible sorrow, of his times when he's almost threatened to, almost driven to give up the work that he's entered into. And I think for a person who's truly going to serve the Lord in these days, that the book of Jeremiah can be a tremendous help to you in your own personal life. You can see how God led Jeremiah, how he protected him, and what he accomplished through him. And you can know that if you're entirely true to him, he may accomplish a great deal through you. But you have to be ready to go against all obstacles and difficulties and discouragements as he was. The book does not give any one of us an assurance that we will continue through a long life to be able effectively to serve the Lord. It does not give us that because it has the account of the other prophet who gave the same message who was killed. And thus we see that it may be God's will to use us through a long life of loyalty to him, or it may be his will that we should witness to him by suffering and by death. But the book should be a great encouragement to us not to abandon the task or turn aside, as so many do when the going gets hard. God has spoken. Some of his servants has things work out smoothly and a great deal seems to be accomplished. Others face tremendous obstacles and don't seem to accomplish much. But if they're really true to the Lord, then no one can say how great the amount may be that they're really accomplishing for him. Only God knows the results. He wants us to be faithful, and he knows truly which results are tremendously important and which aren't. So this first chapter, I think, is a good chapter to read over when you become discouraged at times. But then the second section, I'm going to give a very general title to, Judah's Sin Against God. This second section is emphasizing particularly the people among whom Jeremiah was living. So I'm using the word Judah at the start, because as you know, Jeremiah was in the southern kingdom. And the northern kingdom had been taken into exile about 100 years before this time. And so you can naturally expect that most of his efforts will be spent in dealing with the people of the southern kingdom. The kingdom which could now be called the kingdom of Israel, because the northern one was gone, two-thirds of the people were already in exile. But therefore, it could take the title Israel. It was what remained of Israel. And yet, when there was a northern kingdom that was larger, that took the name Israel, they came to be called by the name of their largest tribe, the kingdom of Judah. And both terms are now used. So when you find the term Israel, you can always ask yourself at this time three questions. Does this term Israel relate to the kingdom of Judah, which is the surviving Israel kingdom? Is it a term for the whole nation here? Or is it here speaking again of the northern kingdom? It illustrates the ambiguity of human language that the term is used in those three ways. Actually, there are comparatively few terms in any language that do not have more than one possibility of interpretation. I was thinking the other day about inerrancy. Is a word in the scripture inerrant? I think the answer is a single word cannot be inerrant. How can a word be inerrant? Because a word doesn't give you any meaning. I say Hatfield. What does that say? It says nothing. Nothing at all. You don't know what Hatfield it is. You don't know whether it is speaking of the palace in which Queen Elizabeth first lived before she became queen, or whether it is speaking of a city in Nebraska, or whether it is speaking of a town in Pennsylvania. And I've even heard people say Hatfield simply referring to the seminary here. The word Hatfield can be used in many ways. The word cannot be considered as inerrant because it conveys no meaning. And you have to have more meaning. You have to have a sentence. And in most cases, a sentence needs context before you can say what it really says. Almost any sentence can give you a little meaning, but almost any sentence raises more questions than it answers, and you need context to answer it, to know what it really says. So in this case, I'm specifically going to call this Judah's Sin Against God. And it would seem to me rather likely, coming right after the account of his call, that this was one of his first messages. The word of God came to me, go and proclaim in the hearing of Jerusalem. And then he starts in a very natural way. I remember the devotion of your youth, how as a bride you loved me and followed me through the desert, through a land not sown. Israel was holy to the Lord, the first fruits of his harvest. All who devoured her were held guilty, and disaster overtook them, declares the Lord. What a recalling that is. What a summary of the way that God delivered them from Egypt and brought the plagues upon the Egyptians, the way he protected them in the journey through the wilderness, and the way that he enabled them to conquer all the land of Canaan. God's tremendous blessing to them in the past is here summarized, thinking particularly about the early days. of the Israelites. And then he says in verse 5, what fault did your fathers find in me that they strayed so far from me? They followed worthless idols and became worthless themselves. And then he continues with speaking of the marvelous blessings that God had given the people and the way that the people had turned against God up through verse 8. And then in verse 9, he makes his arraignment. Therefore, I bring charges against you again, declares the Lord, and I will bring charges against your children's children. Cross over to the coasts of Kittim and look. Send to Kedar. Now, Kittim is a name that refers to all the areas to the west. Some try to prove that Kittim refers specifically to Crete. I think that is highly questionable. There was a small town, a small settlement in Crete, which had a name somewhat similar to the word Kittim. Whether the name Kittim comes from that town or whether the name was already there before the town, we don't know. I was sent a copy of a section from a new translation that someone is preparing. They asked me to look it over, and it wasn't of Jeremiah, it's a different section, but I looked it over, and they had in it translated Kittim as Crete, and I wrote strongly urging them to change that, because the name is clearly used for almost any region west of Palestine. In Palestine, you look out at the Mediterranean Sea, and the name would cover, sometimes it's translated coastlands or isles in the King James and other translations. It is that whole area there which you speak of as Kittim. And so in this case, it simply means look way off to the west. Look at the coast of Kittim. And look, send to Kedar and observe closely. And Kedar is the name of a section of Arabia. So that refers to the east. So he's really saying look in all directions. Look to the west and look to the east and observe closely. See if there's ever been anything like this. Has a nation ever changed its gods? Yet they are not gods at all. But my people have exchanged their glory for worthless idols. Now, are you going to take this as meaning that up to that time no nation ever changed its gods? I think that would be jumping pretty far for a conclusion from what it says. It is a rhetorical statement. Maybe none ever had up to that time, but certainly there have been many instances since where nations have changed their gods. And in America today, as a whole, certainly in most of our universities, certainly in the great mass of the educated people today, the allegiance is not being paid to the God of the Bible, but to the humanistic idea that deifies man. And many blatantly express it that there is no power except man. And man is only the result of a series of accidents. I was much impressed a good many years ago when I visited Constantinople to hear a story of something that I was told had happened when a tourist group came through the town. And they said that there, in the cool morning there, when it was quite chilly, they saw the Muslims there washing their feet in order to be able to go into the mosque, because there they have to take off their shoes to go into the mosque, and that these American who observed it was quite overwhelmed and said, imagine those people, it makes me shiver to think of it, to see them there in the cold, washing their feet in order to go into the mosque. There must be something to this business of religion after all, if it will have that effect on people. Well, it really is a shock to see that attitude of many in America today. They had simply turned away, like the people in Israel had, from the one who has established us and given us all that we have. Has a nation ever changed its gods? Well, he's implying that the people, the Jews, were exchanging the gods, that they had, and that you would find the loyalty of many who believe in lies, who believe in false gods, is so great often that it puts to shame many of us who claim to believe in the true God and who have experienced salvation through Christ. He says, has a nation ever changed its gods? Yet they're not gods at all. But my people have exchanged their glory for worthless idols. And of course, in America, a great part of our educated class has exchanged that made America great for that which is purely imaginary. If you'll read the... Yes? Yes. For that which does not profit is, of course, he's the idols in that case. Of course, in our case, it is not physical idols. That is always a problem in translation. Are you going the New American Standard? By the way, let me say this: that if you know Hebrew and Greek, but don't want to take the time to look everything up in them, you can find the New American Standard probably the most useful of any translation, because it follows the original very, very closely. It follows it so closely that one who doesn't know Hebrew or Greek often fails to get the meaning at all from it, because it follows the original idiom. And there are places where, like this, where what it refers to is clearly understood, but the average reader might not catch it. And so if you know Hebrew and Greek, it is a most useful tool. Now, the New International Version has tried to give the meaning in a way that can be understood easily by people today who don't know Hebrew and Greek, and to preserve as much of the beauty of it as they can. We cannot preserve as much as the King James does, because the King James was written in a language that's far more beautiful than the English language today, the language of 300 years ago. But of course, none of us understand the language of 300 years ago. I've been amazed how many people have read the King James Version all their lives don't know the difference between you and ye. I found very few who know the difference between you and ye. And yet they are used consistently all through the Bible with a definite difference of usage between them. But people read and read and read the Old Testament, read you and ye, and have no idea what the difference is. It simply shows how we need a Bible in our own language. Now, if you're going to put the Bible into your own language, you have to insert words occasionally where the meaning is clear from the context but wouldn't be clear to a reader in your day. And the King James does that a great deal. But when they do, they put it in italics. And today, very few people recognize what italics mean in the King James, and they're apt to emphasize the words that are inserted instead of realizing that they are words that are merely inserted in order to make the meaning clear. And so I don't know of any modern version, I haven't come across any, that uses italics the way the King James does. And so in most of them, you find words inserted that perhaps sometimes go a little too far in their guess. The New International Version has tried very hard to be accurate, but it also has tried very hard to get excellent English and clear English. And I've been on committees working on it when we've come to a verse and one person says, well, here's what it means. The other person says, yes, but that doesn't convey a meaning to people today. That's jumpy, that's awkward, that doesn't convey today's meaning. Do it this way. And the other one says, yes, that's a beautiful presentation of meaning of that verse, but it's not what the original says. And then we have worked for a whole hour trying this, that, and the other, and eventually at the end of the hour, we have made a translation of the verse, which we all agreed was very, very close to the original and was in good, clear English. But you can't spend an hour on every verse. You'd probably spend 10 or 15 years making your translation. And so there are many cases where the NIV translations are most remarkably excellent. And there are other cases where the difference between two possibilities has been decided by a 5-4 vote in a particular committee. And I was on the four side in a number of those cases. And I am sure that there is no one who participated in the NIV translation who would agree with the translation of everything that is in it. But I think that everyone who is on it will agree that the translation is much better than any one of us could have done by ourselves. I think it is a very good translation. But I find occasionally points where it changes the meaning from the King James, where I think the meaning in the King James really represents the original. So the best thing, of course, is to follow the Hebrew and the Greek for yourself. But I have found myself that many, many times, using the NIV sections I didn't work on, the meaning just comes right out of it, where I had read it over and over in the King James before and never stopped to think of the fact that I really didn't understand what that verse meant. I'd just been saying words and not realizing that I had not gotten more than a superficial idea of what it meant. So in this case, worthless, you've exchanged their glory for worthless idols. In the whole context, he's teaching about gods. If you want to say for worthless gods that are no gods, if you want to say for worthless forces, of course, something like that would fit today better, because if you take a book like Cosmos by Sagan, he has got most tremendously interesting material about the stars and the planets and some material about ancient history where he's not always strictly accurate, but has got some very interesting things. Some material in biology and paleontology, which of course he's gotten from others and can't really speak as an authority. But as you read the book, you get the feeling of the tremendous thing that man has accomplished and how we are able now to send our plane so far and to send our satellites so far and what tremendous things we've accomplished. But if you read it closely and carefully, you'll find every now and then that there is that shows, after all, how futile it is. Because when you get to it, you find him describing a universe that is utterly limitless, so limitless nobody can possibly comprehend it, and yet one which is so small in its tiniest perfection that if you read it carefully, you just get the feeling, well, what is man? Just like a little ant that will be run over by a car going by, and that's the end of them. You get that feeling. And then as to what it all amounts to, one place he says, perhaps every tiny electron is itself a whole universe as complex as our whole universe. And then within that great universe, every electron in it is another great universe. And perhaps our whole universe is just a tiny electron of another one that much bigger. Well, these things are scattered here and there through it, but they make your head swim. And they make you realize, if you stop to think of them, that he has no answer for anything, actually. Just a lot of detail that is wonderful we've been able to learn, but a tiny bit in proportion to what God has done. And our knowledge is infinitesimal compared to what God knows. And his philosophy is that everything is purely accidental. And he describes the marvelous intricacy of the universe, and then to imagine that that is came about just by accident, entirely by accident, is surely utter nonsense. But you don't get that impression unless you read it carefully. You can easily get, I imagine most readers of it get the impression, my, what wonders man has accomplished, there's no end to it. He says, actually, if man doesn't destroy himself in the next few centuries, we may be having communication with other people, with other intelligent beings, not people, because they won't be at all like us, way off billions and trillions of miles away, we may be having communication with them. How wonderful. But what will we say? What will it amount to? What understanding will it give you of what life is all about anyway? And so, my people have exchanged their glory for that which is worthless. As it has application to our day, the word idol would seem out of place. But as it has application to the context and to what he is immediately talking about, the word idol exactly fits. So you face to face with the real problem of translation there. Any translation is to some extent an interpretation. And then he says, "Be appalled at this, O heavens, and shudder with great horror. My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water." Now there's a tremendous verse exactly describing America today. In fact, exactly describing our Western world today. In fact, describing most of the thinking world, most of the moving world. Those who are really doing things, they have largely forsaken God and dug their own cisterns, and their cisterns that can't hold water. Whether they be the humanistic, egoistic ideas of our Western world, or whether they be the communist ideas that are strong in the Eastern world and that have such a great fascination for so many people in the West here. In both cases, they are broken cisterns that cannot hold water. And he continues with this rebuke of their sin. This first section I'm going to consider as from chapter 2, verse 1 to 3, verse 5. Judah's sin against God. Now, as you go through these sections and you see this tremendous denunciation, as you see the way he speaks about these people, I don't know how many people stop to realize it, how unique it is, what a tremendous thing it is, that this book, that this Bible should have been kept by the Jew, that it should have been preserved by them, that it should be considered by them as their holy scripture. Somebody asked Frederick the Great, atheistic, cynical, military leader of Prussia 200 years ago, yet his people were largely Christians, and Christianity was being taught all through his kingdom, and he had his court chaplain, and he turned to the chaplain one time. He says, "Give me in a word some evidence for Christianity." And the chaplain said, "The Jews." And the continuance of the Jews, when all the nations of antiquity have disappeared, the continuance of them. The Egypt today is not the same people as ancient Egypt, not the same language, not the same customs, entirely different. And that is true of those that preserve the names from ancient times, and most don't even preserve the names. But the Jews have continued as a separate group, even though scattered through all the world, just as the Bible said that they would. But I don't think that many people who realize even the uniqueness of the preservation of the Jews as a group, I don't think that many people, even those who realize this fact, realize the most amazing fact that they have kept as their sacred writings, which they treasure and of which they look to with such reverence, a book of the nature of the Old Testament. You take the great writings that are treasured by any other nation that I ever heard of, and they tell you how great were the founders of their nation and what tremendous things they did. And they have everything good to say about them. Occasionally they made a mistake once in a while. But to preserve and to honor writings that denounce their people, that accuse them of all kinds of sins, that accuse them of forsaking their God, and use the terms and the criticism and the attack that we find in so many parts of the Old Testament, and that we find great deal of in Isaiah, and still more in Jeremiah, for a nation to take writings like that and preserve them and treasure them and honor them through the ages. It's absolutely unique. And we can be sure that it was no Jewish chauvinism or pride in their nation that led them to preserve these books and consider them as holy books, books they should follow. But it's because God marvelously led that the people should treasure the writings of Jeremiah, not the writings of his opponents, the false prophets, of whom you'll find there were many in that time, and the writings of others who simply glorified the nation. They did not preserve writings of that type. But they did preserve writings that no nation from a purely human purpose would ever think of preserving and honoring and glorifying. But these were the writings of God given to these people whom he had called out for his purpose, and they have preserved them and treasured them. And so we find these great rebukes of them. He says, why do you go to Egypt and go to Assyria? In other words, you're looking for help from all sorts of clever ideas, like those who think now that if we're going to get plenty of oil, we've got to give the Arabs all the technology and the means of defending themselves that we can, even if, who knows, the most absolute monarchy in the world may be taken over by some revolutionary force next year, just like the second most absolute in the world, the Iranian, was 3 or 4 years ago. Who knows what it's going to be, but we think that by trying to please them, we are going to win safety for ourselves and to get plenty of oil for ourselves. So he says in answer to that sort of thing, why go to Egypt to drink water from the Shihor? Why go to Assyria to drink water from the Euphrates? Your wickedness will punish you, your backsliding will rebuke you. Consider and realize how evil and bitter it is for you when you forsake the Lord your God and have no awe of me. Now this second section, which runs through verse 5 in the next chapter, discusses Judah's sin against God. And then we turn to the northern kingdom. We speak of both kingdoms, so we'll look at the third section next time. But the assignment is still in the latter part of the book, and it is posted, I believe, by this time. Anyone who won't be back until next Monday, and anyone who's taking this course for graduate credit, please come and see me immediately.